Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Many of you are probably tuning into our show right now as you're working from home, which in itself is a significant change for many Americans. But though most of us have never lived through a health crisis quite like this, humans have been struggling to deal with the spread of new infectious diseases for centuries. So we thought it might be a good idea to turn to an expert for some historical perspective. Medical historian Mark Honigsbaum tells the story of 20th century infectious diseases in his book, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. In it, Mark provides accounts of the diseases that have thrown humanity and the medical establishment for a loop. The 1918 Spanish influenza, plague in Los Angeles, AIDS, Ebola, SARS, all of these outbreaks challenged previously established medical knowledge and provoked hysteria as public health officials struggled to contain the spread. But though none of these historical examples are a perfect comparison to COVID-19, not even the Spanish flu, Mark's book provides a roadmap for mistakes to avoid as we deal with coronavirus today. The Pandemic Century was published last year and is available at your local bookseller now. Mark Honigsbaum is joining us live from London. Mark, thank you so much for making time for us.
It's a pleasure, Alison.
As I mentioned, this book was published in 2019, before the average person even had any sense of what COVID-19 or coronavirus was. So when you were writing this book, Mark, did you have a sense that something like this might be coming, that we were overdue for a pandemic?
I don't know if we were overdue, because so far this century, before coronavirus, we had had a series of public health emergencies. So if you remember, the century was only 2 years old when we had the SARS outbreak, which started in southern China, like the coronavirus. And we then had the swine flu pandemic of 2009, which was quickly followed by Ebola in 2014 in West Africa, and then Zika in Brazil. So it seems that the rate of these epidemic outbreaks is increasing. I wouldn't have necessarily, or I couldn't have conceived that we'd be in the situation we're in now, though. I have to say that. This is unprecedented.
Is the rate increasing because we are more interconnected via travel generally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a big part of it. So if you look at SARS in 2003, like the coronavirus today, it took a while to get out of China, but it seemed that it took longer to get out of China and into Hong Kong, from where it, you know, was able to board international flights and arrive in Toronto, Vietnam, Thailand, etc. The difference this time is that, you know, the most astounding figure for me is when this outbreak happened in Wuhan back in late December, January. I imagine, like many of your listeners, I'd vaguely heard of Wuhan. What I didn't realize is Wuhan has over 100 direct flights to 70 countries worldwide. I mean, that is astounding. And although the Chinese eventually took drastic action, it clearly was too late. It's always better to bolt the stable door, before the horse has bolted. So I think our chances of ever stopping this spreading were perilously slim.
My guess is Mark Honigsbaum, the name of his book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. So you're a historian and a journalist, which means you go digging and researching. So as you were researching when writing this book, what were some commonalities you found between the way humans have responded to the spread of new infectious diseases? When you think about historically some of the diseases you mentioned, Ebola, SARS.
Yeah, these are very good questions. So as a medical historian, I have to say that, you know, each infectious disease has its own unique identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending on the way it transmits, and the sort of way it presents in terms of, you know, whether the symptoms are florid or even shocking. So cholera would have been a very shocking disease. But the most successful pathogens are the ones that are able to spread silently and widely without causing overt infection until it's too late and the pathogen's everywhere. And that's a little bit like the situation we're in today. So throughout history, there are always rumors and disinformation, distrust of the latest scientific theory or paradigm. And you know, when these pandemics hit, people go looking for knowledge, they go looking for answers. You often see panic and sometimes hysteria too. And we're seeing all of those things today, not just because of the way that the virus spreads and the fact that it's a new virus against which no one has immunity, but we've got the additional challenge today of social media and the way that everything in the world is far more connected than it was, say, even in 1918 during the Spanish flu, and far more connected than it was if you go back to historical outbreaks of plague and cholera in the 19th century.
Many of the pandemics and epidemics you describe in this book are what's called zoonotic diseases. Please correct me if I'm not pronouncing that right, which means transferred from animals to humans.
Correct.
So I think it's worth explaining for those of us who aren't scientists or medical historians, in layman's terms, how exactly does a virus or a disease make a jump from an animal to a human?
Well, I mean, it can make the jump in different ways. It can make the jump just through the food chain, consuming an animal that's consumed another animal, if you see what I mean. But the most common way would be if we ate an animal that was infected with the virus, or we somehow got fluids, either blood or feces more commonly, from that animal reservoir, you know, into our food chain or into the spaces where we cook or eat or live. And what's going on? I mean, a very good film for your viewers to revisit would be Steven Soderbergh's film Contagion, which really maps this with uncanny accuracy to what's happening today. Because that film is based on what if, you know, a new animal pathogen emerged in China somewhere and then got into a diner in Kowloon in Hong Kong and was picked up by a Western business traveler. In the film, it's Gwyneth Paltrow, interestingly, and was brought back to the United States. And this is happening more often, we think, because of the way that the environments, the habitats in which bats and rodents and other wild animals that act as reservoir hosts, the way that those environments, those habitats are under extreme pressure, either from environmental change, climate change, but more usually because of human populations encroaching more and more into virgin forested areas, either for timber or for food or simply, you know, for agriculture, agricultural settlements.
Yeah, there was an example you cited in your book. I'm looking at my pages scrolling through about deforestation. What was that example again?
Well, so a good example is Ebola in 2014. I think that's what you're referring to. So we don't really know why Ebola, which had previously been a virus that was confined to Central Africa, to, you know, equatorial Africa, why it suddenly popped up in Guinea in West Africa, which is about 2,000 miles away from where the previous outbreaks had been. And one theory is that there'd been a lot of road building, there'd been a lot of clearing of forested areas for timber, and the when you remove the habitats, the trees, where in this instance bats roost, then the bats have to go somewhere else. Where do they go? Well, it appears that many of them ended up either on the edge of a small village or in a hollowed out tree stump in the middle of the village where children and people played and barbecued in the outside. And that village was no longer so remote as it had been 10 years previously, because there were roads. You could pick up a main road to Conakry, the capital of Guinea, or you could cross the border very quickly, and there were new Chinese-made roads all the way to a free town in Sierra Leone and Monrovia in Liberia.
My guest is Mark Honigsbaum. The name of his book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. Let's talk about hubris.
Yes,
that word stands
out. My favorite
out.
Word. Very yes. Apposite right now.
How did hubris play a role in the spread of infectious disease over the 20th century?
So the best way to think of hubris is as, a form of complacency, really. Thinking that we know enough about something, that we've got enough scientific knowledge, and even if we don't know everything about, you know, the sort of threat that a particular virus or disease presents, we've got the tools and equipment to quickly get on top of it. So it's this part of the problem is that, you know, our responses to epidemics and pandemics are always guided by what's gone before and what we've discovered previously. You know, if studying epidemics in history has taught me anything, it's that no two epidemics or pandemics are exactly alike. And that while medical knowledge can be a great help if, you know, informs research into vaccines and therapeutic drugs, it can also blindside us to, you know, an unknown pathogen, the so-called disease X that may be just around the corner.
It's interesting. You describe the pathogen at one point resembling a child with a tantrum.
Yes. So I was trying to describe the way that influenza, I think, is what I was talking mm-hmm. about, the way, trying to use that as a metaphor for virulence, the way that, you know, a virus can mutate and change. And like a small child with a tantrum, it can get out of control and its behavior can escalate quite dramatically.
You write that before the outbreak of SARS, coronaviruses were considered the Cinderellas of the virus world, beautiful to look at after work, but too insignificant to take up a microbiologist's daylight hours. Why did they have this belief about coronaviruses?
Well, I mean, so this is the interesting thing about why we don't have a vaccine or therapeutic now, because what happens is that scientists, medical researchers, get paid, get financed to research pathogens that either, for which there's either a lucrative potential medical market or which get prioritized. But we can't prioritize everything. Previous to SARS in 2003, we knew coronaviruses caused the common cold and another obscure veterinary disease. But if you were building a career as a scientist, it wasn't a very interesting thing to research. You weren't, you know, going to get very far, which is why those sort of things have to be prioritized and supported, because otherwise they are neglected. And even after SARS, where we had the lesson, we really need to study this and know a bit more and develop, you know, platforms for vaccines, there was a burst of investment, but then it just petered away and we forgot about it. So there's a kind of cultural amnesia that sets in as soon as the epidemic's over.
My guest is Mark Honigsbaum. The name of his book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. So there have been quite a few stories circulating comparing COVID-19 to the outbreak of Spanish flu in 1918. There have been pieces in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle that seek to find lessons to apply to COVID-19. But the New York Times ran a piece that was titled Coronavirus is Very Different from the Spanish Flu of 1918. Here's how. First of all, is there value in comparing coronavirus, this outbreak, to the 1918 influenza, in your opinion?
Yes, I think there is. And I would disagree with that New York Times piece. No, I don't think it is 1918. As I said previously, no two pandemics are alike, and it's a big mistake to think that they might be. If nothing else, the pathogens are completely different, and we live in very different historical and cultural space. Having said that, there are remarkable echoes, is how I would put it. So the first time that this really struck me was when, if you remember early on in the outbreak, we started to see these extraordinary scenes from Wuhan, where overnight the Chinese constructed these massive hospitals. And then you saw these pictures of what they called emergency waiting rooms to take the overspill of all the patients who were besieging the emergency rooms. And those pictures of patients laid out and rows of makeshift beds or cots are very reminiscent of the images that had been handed down to us from principally actually from U.S. Army encampments, which all over the United States, where in the first wave of Spanish flu, you saw large numbers of troops sickened very rapidly, and they overwhelmed the hospital services, and they had to requisition hangars and auditoriums where you got rows and rows of patients. There are other similarities too. So this is an aerosol pathogen. It doesn't spread in quite the same way as flu. It tends to move in a more lumbering way, if I can put that, in these family clusters. And we don't really know how efficiently it spreads over long distances in the open air. Probably not that efficiently. Otherwise, we would have seen even more cases than we're seeing now. But it does have a very similar mortality rate. The other major difference, of course, is that in 1918, the people who bore the brunt of infections and mortality were the people in the middle age ranges, young adults between the age of 20 and 40. Whereas today with coronavirus, we know that the principal threat is to those actually my age, 59 and over. But I'm principally concerned about my mother, who lives in London, is 88, you know. So I think this is really different to flu in that respect, that we really need to look out for the most vulnerable elderly segments of our population.
Mark, what role did racism play in how some of these 20th century illnesses were thought of both by public and health officials?
Well, I mean, epidemic diseases always shine a harsh light on all the fault lines and prejudices in society. This is one of the great learning points, really, from the field that I began studying after I quit journalism, the social history of medicine. So the social history of medicine teaches us that epidemics are sort of kind of framing devices, almost windows onto, inequalities and, you know, structures in society that may not be that visible during normal times. And we're seeing this writ large. So if you remember the beginning of the epidemic, there were these headlines in French newspapers about the yellow peril. People started to shun Chinese and Asian people who were wearing face masks, in public spaces. There was a lot of talk about these dangerous exotic food practices because it's thought that COVID-19 disease originated in one of these wild animal markets in Wuhan. So, you know, all these sort of judgments, prejudicial judgments were made. But as we're seeing now, the virus is no respecter of nation, race, or class. And in that respect, again, it's very, very similar to influenza. If I can, I'd like to share a poem with your listeners, actually.
Sure.
That Winston Churchill wrote when he was 15. It was one of the first poems he wrote as a schoolboy at Harrow. And it was during an earlier epidemic called the Russian influenza epidemic. And he wrote that the high, the low, the rich, the poor, alike before the symptoms bow, alike before, I've garbled the thing. But anyway, his point was that it was no respecter of your situation or class. Everybody got flu.
And Mark, as you mentioned, you are a journalist, and you do cite some interesting examples of the different ways the press can handle an outbreak of a potentially highly contagious disease. What have you observed about the media coverage so far of COVID?
Well, I mean, I think some of the media coverage has been very poor and alarmist, to catch on your earlier point, you know, so headlines and tabloids about killer viruses or mayhem, or headlines like the one I quoted in the French paper warning about being on yellow alert, with all its connotations of, you know, prejudice against, you know, Chinese people and the idea of the yellow peril. I think those are appalling, and what they do is they sow more fear, division, and distrust, which is exactly the opposite to what we need at this moment. We need to realize that we're all one big global community, and that, you know, we can't just stop this virus by, you know, stopping people flying in from one country or another. And my big worry now is how do we unwind the situation? It will take collective action and coordinated political leadership from all the major nations.
The name of the book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. Mark Honigsbaum is the author. Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Allison. It was a pleasure.